you.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Charlotte Mecklenburg Schools are about to embark on a new adventure. True, school starts in just a few short weeks, and that's always an adventure for students and teachers, parents and administrators, but that's not what I'm talking about. I'm referring to the arrival of a new school superintendent, Dr. Heath Morrison, who arrived in town just a month or so ago and has been working furiously to get his footing and deal with all of the issues his predecessor left behind. Given some of the challenges facing the state's largest school system, it makes you wonder how anyone can do the job, or why anyone would want it. But Dr. Morrison wanted it. He was chosen for it, so now what? That's what we'll spend this hour talking to him about. Dr. Morrison, welcome to Charlotte and to Charlotte Talks. Nice to see you. Nice to meet you.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be on.
I feel like I know you already. You were here a lot between, I guess, April, and when you arrived here permanently in July, and all of the media and your face in the newspaper, you really made the rounds.
Yeah, I did. I don't know why anyone would put my face on the front of the newspaper, but they're trying to sell the news. So I'm much better on radio than I think I am in print media.
Oh, well, you do damage to yourself unnecessarily. Anybody who's been following the story of your election in the media knows that you came to Charlotte from the, what is it, Washoe or Washoe?
Oh, you got it right the first time. Okay. Washoe.
Okay, the Washoe County School District, which is Reno, Nevada School District.
Okay, but now, hold on a second. You got Washoe right, but you got to say Nevada right, because if you ever go out to the state, so I don't want them to treat you nicely. So it's
Nevada.
Washoe County, Reno, Nevada.
Why do they pronounce it wrong?
the local context is the local context, and my wife, who is a English teacher by trade, was going to not say Nevada. She was going to say Nevada, and that lasted for about a week, and then she switched Nevada as well. So
see, I've already learned something.
There
that's
you
why
go.
You're the superintendent
yeah.
of school.
Yeah,
that's right there. So that's the second largest school system in the state of Nevada.
It is.
With 63,000 students, CMS is twice that, more than twice that large.
Right.
So it's 141,000 students, 159 schools, and how many employees?
Over 18,000.
Wow. With multiple languages being spoken in the school system here, right. How many languages were spoken on average in Reno?
Well, there is probably, when you have 64,000 children, there are multiple languages.
Sure.
But really, predominantly, you either had students who spoke English as a primary language or Spanish. But there were over 25 different languages spoken in the school district, but the predominant ones were English and Spanish.
And every school district has its challenges. Every school district has its problems. We have budget problems, as most school districts around the country do, because of the recession. We've had for years growing pains, which I think have slowed down because of the recession to a certain degree. We have image problems within the community. We have morale problems within the system. We have unfinished discussions over the impact of end-of-year testing and the value of end-of-year tests and some of the tests that were being tested because of the Broad Institute. Why, then, did you want this job? This comes with a lot of built-in complications.
Well, it's a fair question. So I was very happy in my day job in Reno, Nevada. It was a great school district, a wonderful community. They were really embracing the things that we were trying to do to make things better for children, and I was very fortunate to have a lot of job opportunities being offered, and lots of great districts and lots of wonderful opportunities, and I was saying no to every single one of them because I was very committed to the work that we were doing in Reno. When CMS became open and I started getting phone calls about this particular opportunity, Charlotte-Mecklenburg is a school district that I've had quite a bit of experience with when I was an area superintendent in Montgomery County, Maryland, which is it's an interesting district to compare against CMS because Montgomery County, Maryland, is about the same size, actually a little bigger, even more diversity in terms of languages and demographic of students. And so having had experience out in that school district, we started benchmarking with CMS. When I went out to Reno, Nevada as superintendent, CMS was a school district that we were exploring a lot of the things that were happening, a lot of the initiatives, a lot of the strategies, and so I was building relationships with people within the district. So it was a situation when I was getting the phone calls. It was a job when I sat down with my wife and I said, you know, what I want to do as a superintendent is I want to really make my mark by picking a district, staying a long time, building a foundation. So it's not just making it better, but you can look at really making positive student improvement over an extended period of time. Jerry Wiest in Montgomery County, Maryland, stayed over 10 years. Gwinnett County in Georgia, their superintendent's been there over 13 years. Garden Grove, California, their superintendent's been there 13 years. When you look at what they've done, it hasn't just been some quick fixes, some quick victories. It's been sustained growth, building something for a long period of time. And so that's really what I wanted to do. Our family is almost entirely on the East Coast, mostly in Florida and Virginia. So the proximity to our family, my relationships with people in the school district, the good foundation that's already been started here in CMS. And then really, for me, what was the selling point for why I said, yeah, I think I'm going to go ahead and go forward in this process was this community. This is a community that values a quality of education. They understand why education is important. And when they believe in terms of what you're doing and the vision that you're trying to put together in a shared way, the support that you can rally is incredible to make a difference for children. So those were all things that really made me want to pursue this opportunity.
That answer is packed with questions.
Yeah,
so
okay.
Let me ask some of them. You said you got phone calls about this job. Did we pursue you? Or
you know,
were the phone calls coming from people encouraging you, saying, this is open, you should really apply for this?
Yeah, so you know, I was starting to get phone calls from people connected with the system very early on. And then when the school district selected a superintendent search firm, that firm quickly identified a list of people that they were going to really go after to see if they could get them interested in the position. And so I started getting phone calls about this job right after the search firm was selected. And I didn't commit to moving forward through it until about a month before the actual deadline. So,
and you also said that you were in the best of all possible worlds as a superintendent. You want to find a place where you want to stay for a long period of time.
And yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of superintendents will come in, they'll stay for a couple of years, and then they'll leave. For me, what I really want to do is to select an area and stay for an extended period of time so that it's not just quick fixes or quick victories. It is a sustained building of something that really can last and be substantially better than when you found it.
But you arrived in Reno in 2009.
Yes.
It's 2012.
Yes.
So was there something wrong with Reno? Was there something more attractive about CMS? Why, if you want to stay a long time, 3 years is not a long time.
Well, and again, that was something we really had to have discussions about. We, up until January of 2012, I really thought we were going to put some very deep roots down in Reno. We actually, to the point, my father passed away right before we went out to Reno, and so I brought my mother out to see if she would consider relocating. Mm-hmm. Reno is a very mountainous area, and she has a series of health issues that just precluded her from being able to move out. So that was one of the things that really prompted us to say, okay, if we're going to want to stay in a place for an extended period of time, how far away can you be from extended family? And my wife's family is all on the East Coast. My family is on the East Coast. So it was at that point we really started to decide, okay, if we're going to put deep roots down, then, you know, while we've got kids in school, while we've got family considerations, if it's not going to be Reno, which we loved, and it was an amazing community and very welcoming my family, very welcoming to things we were doing, then Charlotte Mecklenburg was very attractive.
Are you going to miss the gambling? It's a joke question.
You know, it is an interest. You know, you go from Montgomery County, Maryland to Reno, Nevada.
Yes.
And I do remember my first principal meeting, and the person that was taking me to the meeting, we arrived at one of the casinos, and I'm like, what are we doing here at 7 o'clock in the morning? And that's where we were having the principal meeting. So that lasted for a couple of months before we shifted to the community college. So it's a different experience, and like anything else, it helps develop your own personal experiences that help you grow as a leader.
You know, your predecessor, Dr. Peter Gorman, and his predecessor, and I've forgotten his name now.
Eric Smith.
Thank you, Eric Smith. Both talked, as you just spoke of, the national reputation of CMS and how you as a superintendent in Reno and as a, what was your position in Montgomery County?
I was an area superintendent.
An area superintendent. Yeah. Looked at some of the policies and practices of CMS because they do have national attention.
Yes.
And yet if you talk about CMS within this community, you get a different impression. It's like we're dying on the vine. It's the worst school system in the country. nobody gets a good education at CMS, blah, blah, blah. How can there be such an enormous disconnect?
Well, it's a fantastic question, and quite frankly, that's probably been what I've been spending most of my time as superintendent exploring with this community. When I was announced as a superintendent, when I would be presenting at a conference, when I was other places in the country, phone calls and emails and People were congratulating me, saying, "Hey, CMS, what an excellent school district! You have to be really excited about the things that you could do." And then I was arriving here, getting off the airplane, and people were recognizing me and patting me on the back, saying, "Good luck," as if exactly like you said, that this was some sort of fixer-upper. So, you know, what I learned a long time ago is your brand isn't what you say you are. Your brand is what people say about you. And so what I truly believe is that our national reputation, we probably aren't as good as people think we are nationally. We are far better than what many people in the community think we are. And so I think what we have to do is to really articulate what it is that we're trying to do for our children, come up with some goals, targets, and indicators that the community feels are the right ones. We measure an awful lot in CMS. I'm not sure we're always measuring the things that are most important to our community and our parents. And then in the most transparent, proactive way, hold ourselves accountable and let people know when we're hitting the targets and when we're making successes. And then when we fail to do that, to explain why and tell them what we're doing about it.
You bring up an interesting point. I would think the national reputation of CMS is among professionals in the world of education. And the local reputation of CMS is among parents.
Well, I think it's certainly amongst parents, but it's community members, it's taxpayers, it's everybody who's connected by education, businesses.
So is the disconnect between educators and those other people? In other words, educators see school systems one way and the rest of us see them another way. If that's the case, who's right?
I'm not sure it's a either-or proposition. I think what you have to do is to enter into the conversation and define success. I mean, I'll promise you, in my experience, the number one issue that most school districts have is that there's never been a solid definition of success. What is it that we're actually trying to do that's going to tell us whether or not we have a good school district, a great school district, an unsuccessful school district? What is our plan? What's the vision? What's the definition of success? Then you have to make sure that there's lots of people who weigh in on that. It can't just be the superintendent. Can't just be the board. As we revisit our strategic plan, I've got a community town hall meeting tonight. I'm asking those questions. What are the things that are important? What are your definitions of success? We have to fold all of those things in there so that then we can create the appropriate targets and measures, hold ourselves accountable for it. I don't think the national reputation, I think it's maybe a little oversimplistic to say it's just educators. There are a lot of groups across the country that have a keen interest in education, education reform, educational excellence, who have weighed in to really say CMS is a very good school district. It's good compared to other large school districts. It's good compared to other urban districts. But I'm not interested in being a tall tree in a short forest. I want to be great for all kids. At the end of the day, here's what I know. It's not so much to me the reputation amongst the nation or even the community. It's are we excellent for 141,000 reasons because we have 141,000 kids we're trying to educate.
You came before Reno. You were, as I said, in Montgomery County, Maryland schools.
And yes.
I went to public school in Alexandria, Virginia.
I did too.
Really?
Yes, Patrick Henry Elementary School.
I almost went there. I was in parochial school then, but I would have gone to Patrick Henry. We could have been. No, we couldn't have. You're much younger than me. But I was there during the Pleistocene age, and I remember that when we had to do academic competitions against schools in Montgomery County, Maryland, which is on the other side of the Beltway, it was shiver in your boots time because that school system was excellent.
Yes.
And they produced high academic achievers.
Absolutely.
Is that still the case today? I have 20 seconds.
Yeah, absolutely. Montgomery County, I think if you ask people externally or internally across the country, you're going to hear when you ask what are the very best school districts in the country, you won't get far before you hear Montgomery County, Maryland. I was honored to have been an educator in that district.
I want to talk about them and us when we come back. Dr. Heath Morrison is our guest, superintendent of Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members at Horizon Eye Care's Pediatric Ophthalmology Department, welcoming Dr. Benjamin Kramer, now accepting new patients at the Huntersville University and Cotswold locations. Appointments at 704-365-0555. Everybody knows Tavis Smiley. He can be seen and heard daily on public television and radio. He's written 16 books, recently named one of Time Magazine's 100 most influential people in the world. And you know that he has a major exhibit running at the Harvey B. Gantt Center. America I Am, the African-American imprint, is his brainchild. He joined us a few months ago to talk about how this all came to be, and we'll hear that conversation again, an encore presentation of our conversation with Tavis Smiley, tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm show, the White House says it's starting to get ready for potentially painful year-end spending cuts. Debate over how sequestration could affect the government and the economy.
Join that conversation on the Diane Rehm show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks. Here on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is Dr. Heath Morrison, the new superintendent of Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools, who, by the way, tonight kicks off a series of community town hall meetings. Tonight's meeting is at 6 at Rocky River High School on Clear Creek Commerce Drive. There are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 others. So there's 7 town hall meetings for the community. But there's one tonight, one in September, 3 in October, 2 in November.
Yep.
Because one of the things you want to do is listen, and we'll talk about that in a couple of seconds.
Right.
I want to compare Montgomery County schools, Montgomery County, Maryland schools, to what you know about CMS, because they are, as you said, an excellent school district. They do have problems.
Every school district does.
And challenges, but they are academically, historically, and for years now, 30 or so years, have been academically excellent as a public school system. Mm-hmm. Of course, Montgomery County, Maryland, and Fairfax County, Virginia, are two of the wealthiest counties in the country. We're no slouch.
Right.
So how do we compare?
Well, the area of schools that I supervised as an area superintendent in Montgomery County was the poorest, most highly mobile, English second language learners, highest population. It was the area of Montgomery County that sits right next to the District of Columbia and Prince George's County. So it was very interesting to be a zone superintendent in a area of a school district that looks nothing like the rest of the school district. But what we really were focused on was not only getting kids to graduate, but what does the quality of the diploma mean? And that is something that I've really tried to push since becoming the superintendent here in CMS. We've been very focused the last few years in the school district about increasing graduation rates, and I think that's absolutely essential. But a high school diploma used to be a real opportunity for the future. Now it's simply, if you don't have one, it really shuts a lot of doors to you. So it can't just be the quality of the diploma. It can't just be getting a diploma. It has to be the quality diploma. In Montgomery County, Maryland, we really looked at that we wanted that diploma to be part of our brand. It was a certification that if you had a Montgomery County diploma, you were ready to go to college without needing remedial courses. You were ready to get a highly skilled career. You were ready to go to the military and not need support. I want that same thing for our students here in CMS. So I want the graduation rates to go up, but I want the quality of a CMS diploma to really mean that it's a passport for a better tomorrow.
How do you do that?
Well, I think, first of all, it gets back to what I said. How do we define success? This is a school district that long before many other school districts were doing this, it started measuring a lot of things that I think are important, that are relevant, but it's measured so many things. If you measure everything, you can't really prioritize the things that really bubble up as the most important issues. And so what I know is that there are targets that really show us that children are on a pathway to stay and get graduated, but it also tells us if they are on a pathway to be able to graduate and go right to college without remedial courses. So are they highly literate at the end of second grade? When do they take algebra successfully? How many AP and IB courses are they taking in high school? Those are the things that I think are really important to parents. Those are the things that I think matter to the community. Other things are absolutely important. Growth over time, absolutely important. Other key performance indicators. But those are more internal for us to get our processes right. But in terms of outcomes that the community holds important, we really need to focus on those things because at the end of the day, that does speak to the quality of a diploma.
You mentioned that CMS may have been measuring too many things because when you measure too many things, you can't get a perspective on things. Measuring how? Through testing?
Well, I think there's certainly through academic performance, there's a lot of testing. Both formative and summative or leading and lagging indicators. But we measure a great number of things. We measure operational efficiencies. We have key performance indicators in a lot of areas that tell us are the operational side of our organization really complementing the academic side. These are all good things. They should be measured. They should be reported out to the community. But in terms of what we put out there, I always say, when I was a high school principal and someone first would come up to me and say, hey, Dr. Morrison, how's the high school going to do this year? And I'd say, well, you know, we're going to try to get better on tests and, you know, academic achievement. We're going to try to have fewer student incidents of discipline. And, oh, by the way, I hope our state football team might win states. It used to be the only thing that a group of parents could hold me accountable for was the performance of the football team, because that was the only thing that actually got quantified and measured. Today, there's a plethora of ways that individuals, parents, community members, taxpayers can hold schools accountable for results. We measure a lot of things. And so now when you ask the question, I can stand up there and sound very much like an educrat. Well, we made AYP by meeting and exceeding the AMO. We needed the confidence interval in these subgroups. Our ACT scores went up. Our SAT scores went down. And, oh, by the way, I hope our football team wins states. So we have put all sorts of measures out there. I think at the end of the day, parents really just want to understand the key things. Is my kid reading well, writing well, doing math well? Are they getting a rigorous instruction? Are you making a commitment to my child, whether my child is a special needs student? Is my child a student who already came in well advanced? We have to have a commitment to every single child. And I think back to your question when you asked about the comparison to Montgomery County versus Charlotte-Mecklenburg. In Montgomery County, there was a fierce commitment to every single child, just as there is in Charlotte-Mecklenburg. But I think what we understood was, in terms of how we message that commitment, we've got to talk about all of our children. And it's, we have as much of a commitment to that student who is struggling and may not get promoted to the next grade, but we have an equal commitment to that student who comes in a fifth grade reading at a seventh grade reading level to increase their reading proficiency as well. And I think somehow in the messaging of CMS, that's been a little lost.
You talked about the demographics makeup of your area that you were responsible for in Montgomery County, Maryland. You said that was next door to Prince George's County, Maryland, which is not one of the richest counties in the country. The polar opposite, and right next to the District of Columbia, which is urban, and so is Prince George's County. The whole area is urban.
Exactly.
Actually. So how did your part of the world of Montgomery County schools meet up with the other half of Montgomery County schools? How did the 99%, which you were responsible for, match the 1%?
Yeah, I was very fortunate when I was recruited to come into that particular opportunity by the superintendent, Jerry Wiest. He was very clear. He wanted to be able to look at test data across the six performance zones in Montgomery County and not immediately identify what he called the red zone. Mm-hmm. The red zone being the highest concentration of kids who were impacted by poverty, mobility, and English as second language. So I had some non-negotiables, which included I needed to have the first selection of principals. We needed to have some freedoms that I thought were very important. Those things were extended to my schools, and we really were able to produce some very good results in my time as an area superintendent. I credit that to our amazing teachers in those schools, some excellent principals. But we went from being the worst performing zone in Montgomery County to being about third, tied for third.
You were superintendent of the year in 2011 in Nevada.
I was.
Almost everything I've read about you, you were well liked in Nevada. Which is an accomplishment for a superintendent.
How about that?
Yeah. So describe your approach to education. Describe your approach. How you deal with principals and with teachers. What your expectations are of those people. How you deal and interface with parents and students.
Yeah, so it's for me, being superintendent is an opportunity to be a servant leader. And when you're a servant leader, you don't walk in a room thinking you're the smartest person. You don't think you have all the answers. As a matter of fact, I think my job is to have good questions and then do a lot of listening. At the end of the day, the most important employees in a school district are the teachers. They are the people who directly touch children every single day. So when I look at the organization of a school district, instead of having this big chart with the board and the superintendent and principals and executive staff, then somewhere buried are teachers, I prefer to look at it as a series of three circles. In the middle of it, you have students. They are our customers, they're our clients, that's who we serve. The next ring are our teachers, and they are the people who touch kids every single day. Their success dictates the success of the entire school district and ultimately outcomes for children. And then the next rung amongst an organizational flow is support staff, and that is your bus drivers, your secretaries, but it's also your principals, it's also your executive staff, and it's also the superintendent. I am support staff for quality teachers and principals. And so that's really the way I try to approach this job. I want to have teachers feel that they have an amazing voice in the direction of the school district. I want principals to really feel empowered to make decisions that they need to at their schools. I talk about alignment all the time, only in as much as I want the organization, the school district, to be an aligned district where The strategic plan of the district flows through the school improvement plans, flows through the individual plans for teachers and principals. But then you allow creativity and you step away from that alignment so that when you're different, it's different by being better, not different just because we've always been different in this way. So I try to really make sure that that is the way I approach this job. It's the only way I know how to do this job. So when I say I seek first to understand, then to be understood, I've tried to show that commitment in every leadership opportunity I've ever had.
During the search for the superintendent here, we had discussions on this program on and off the air with people who cover education for the right. Observer and for our station and other entities as well. And one of the things that was quite clear in our discussions, both on and off the air, was that you, of the candidates, had really, really done your homework on this system. You yep. knew things, you knew people, you knew places, you knew statistics to an astounding degree. It was like you had been here for quite a while, which I think is why you got this job, among other things. But nothing can really prepare you for the reality of being behind the desk.
Absolutely.
So when you arrived here, and things began to unfold, and you've already begun the listening process. What surprised you most that you didn't anticipate, and what on your list of things to do is at the top?
Well, I do pride myself on being prepared. I always say I'm a teacher on special assignment, and I think great teachers do their homework as much as they ask their students to do their homework. So to come into, as I said to you earlier, it was a hard decision for me to leave Reno. When I made the decision to pursue this opportunity, I wanted to be prepared. And so that's just something I think is very, very important for a leader to demonstrate. So when I came into this position, I'll say I can't really speak about being behind the desk. I have yet to sit at my desk in my office. and I probably will be saying that 10 years from now. I'm just I try to not be in the office a whole lot. I try to be in schools and classrooms a lot. So on a positive note, I knew the sense of pride that people have about living in Charlotte. I was hearing that all over the country. People would say, oh, Charlotte, Mecklenburg, what a great community. You're going to love living there. I have yet to hear anybody across the country or in this community not talk about that pride of living in this community. I want to capture that so that people have that same sense of pride about the school district. And we've got some ways to go on there, but I'm committed to seeing that happen. Here's one thing I will tell you right away. You will hear these words out of my mouth a lot. Processes and systems. And it is something that I think is absolutely incumbent upon any organization, large or small, to be able to say, we have processes, we have systems. When things happen in the media, things happen in the community where people are upset about the school district, take away the issue. Usually when you track down what is the negativity about the story, it's that we had problems around our processes and systems. And so on Monday, I brought in a group that we've worked with both in Montgomery County and in Reno, Nevada, called APQC, American Productivity Quality Control, out of Houston. And what they help organizations do is identify what are your key processes and systems. Does everybody in the organization understand those are the key processes and systems? Have you measures to really make sure that you can identify progress on those systems? And then do you commit to continuous improvement around those? We are going to start on a visual process map documenting every important processing system, make sure we quantify it, then we're going to put it on our website. So when a community member, when a parent, when a taxpayer says, well, how do you do a procurement in CMS? How do you select principals? How do you choose a new textbook or curricula? We can not only have that explanation for them, but we can direct them right to our website so they can see that. And then not only can they see it, but they can give us feedback if they think that they've got an idea that can help us be better. But those processes and systems, it really makes the efficiency and the effectiveness of the operation of the system go much better.
What did you teach?
I taught social studies.
Hmm. And why did you want to get into education?
Well, so very quickly, you know, we both come from Alexandria, and I had done very, very well in elementary school, and then went to my dad was in the military, ended up going to an English school, not doing anywhere near as well. And by the time I got back to the States, I was really behind. I was well on my way to being one of those 1.2 million children who drop out of school every year. Two teachers really rescued me in Fairfax County, and they saw something in me that I think I had forgotten, and they got me back on the right track. They got me into honors courses, and I became the first in my family to go on to graduate and go to college. I was going to save the world through law. I worked my way through college, and was all set to go to law school, and then decided, you know, I really didn't want to try to work my way through law school. So I had picked up some educational courses, and so I was going to live at home with mom and dad, teach for a couple of years, and go back to law school. So, and when I say I'm not the smartest person in any room, I actually thought I could make some money teaching. Started teaching and absolutely found my passion. I loved teaching. It was such an incredible opportunity. Every day was different. Every day you felt like you could make a difference. And I just knew I was never going back to law school, although I think as a superintendent it would have helped me to get a law degree as well. But I could have been very happy staying in the classroom. I was recruited out of the classroom by a principal who I said no to twice when he wanted to make me assistant principal. Third time he said two words that changed my life: required opportunity. And I became an administrator, which is why I tell any aspiring principal or aspiring leader that I encounter in Charlotte-Mecklenburg, if you start off the conversation, "Hey, Dr. Morrison, I want to be a principal in the school district," if the next words out of your mouth are, "Because I'm tired of the classroom," we don't need to have any more conversation. You want to be a leader. You want to be a principal in CMS because you honor the classroom. You honor teachers. You want to be support staff for those teachers.
And so it's really hard to be a teacher.
It's incredibly hard to be a teacher.
It's particularly hard to be a teacher in the modern world where we have No Child Left Behind and end-of-year testing, and we're in the last several years, at least here, I know this from conversations with teachers, they feel remarkably underappreciated. They feel as though their professionalism is under attack. Certainly under question.
Yes.
They are not allowed to do what they feel they do best, teach the way they feel they need to get the message across with the group of children sitting in front of them. They have to conform to what somebody in an ivory tower has told them to do. You have been in the classroom. You've been a superintendent. How do you bring those things together and give these people their dignity? Because you make a hell of a lot more money than they do.
Indeed. Yeah. So, you know, I think what's really important is it comes back, and again, I say the same things over and over again because they're what I believe, but it's how we define success. If all we're doing is putting more and more targets out there, then that means you have to have more and more tests. And then you get into this very worthy conversation of how much time is there to actually teach, because how much time are you investing in the testing? So I think you have to have an appropriate amount of testing for an appropriate amount of targets, but the targets have to be really meaningful. I have not been one that bashed No Child Left Behind because I think overall it did more good than bad. I think it made us focus on subgroups of students that this country has traditionally underserved. It brought accountability at a time when public education wasn't welcoming it. But somewhere we kind of lost the key essentials. And so we as a country, I think nationally, each state, each community really has to have this conversation about what is it that ultimately we want children to be able to know and do when they leave our public education systems or any educational system. And then we have to backward engineer what that looks like. And I think I always want to separate are highly effective and effective teachers versus just saying teachers as a whole. When I was a social studies teacher, I sat next door to a person who taught the Civil War the whole year. Why did he teach the Civil War the whole year? Because that's what he liked. Now, I'm sure the children next door to me got amazing results on Civil War, but there's more to American history than just that. So there has to be a key between honoring individual choices and also making sure we focus on the most important things.
We've gotten a lot of comments and questions from listeners. When we come back, we'll share those with you. Dr. Heath Morrison, our guest, the new superintendent at CMS. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Dove's Nest, treating the physical, emotional, social, and vocational issues of addiction, opening a new 120-bed facility to serve up to 90 women and 30 children at a time. Details at charlotterescuemission.org. The White House says it's preparing federal agencies for possible year-end mandated spending cuts. Debate over how sequestration could affect the government, military, and the economy. That's the topic of the conversation at 10 on the Diane Rehm Show. And if you'd like to join our conversation with Charlotte-Mecklenburg's new superintendent of schools, Dr. Heath Morrison, get on the phone, 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE, or online at WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
Hi, I'm Kurt Anderson, host of Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Join me each week, Sundays at 2 o'clock, as we explore pop culture and the arts. Every week, we introduce you to the people who are creating and shaping our culture. So let Studio 360 steer you to the must-see movie this weekend, the next book for your nightstand, or the song that might change your life. That's Sunday at 2 on listener-supported 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dr. Heath Morrison, superintendent of Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools, is our guest for the first time. And you will find that the superintendent of Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools is a relative star in our community. And you will be called upon to be on this and many other shows over the course of your tenure far too often, in your opinion.
It will be my honor. And my hope is that I outlast you.
Oh, my God.
That may not happen, but that's my goal.
Well, I'm close to the end of the snake. Let me just tell you that. One of the things that emerged, that you said emerged as you visited the city and schools in the weeks leading up to your appointment, and then after you got the appointment and you started making the rounds here, even before you arrived, is that you realized that people did not believe that the system, CMS, was listening to their concerns, and that led them to distrust the system and discount its accomplishments. And you characterize this as perceived deafness. What does that mean?
Well, I think what happens is there's something that I call public trust capital. And it's a very simple concept in my mind. When the public overall trusts what you're doing, then you can do really important things. If they don't trust you, then as you try to go out there and say, we're going to do this initiative or this strategy, then there's automatically questions. So when I say what you have to sort out is, what is it that you actually own? But it gets back to what I said about brand. It's not about what you say you are. It's what people say about you. And so what I want to do is to figure out, in terms of the concepts, the images, the ideas that people have about CMS. And I think, first of all, it's an exaggeration when people say everybody's down on it. I mean, I have had, I promise you, by a two-thirds margin, more people come up to me and say, my kid got a great education in CMS. I'm really proud of the district. I don't have my children in the district, but I would put my kids in the district if I had kids. So I think there's a silent majority of people who really understand it's a good school district. But for the people who are unhappy, I think there were some things that happened, and we have to separate what actually are legitimate so that we can fix them, and then what are misconceptions that we have to educate people that, no, that's not really the way it is.
And because you're new and because of what you've discovered about this perceived deafness, I know that you're launching this series of listening town hall meetings with parents, with anybody who wants to show up at these town hall meetings, beginning tonight at 6 o'clock, this one at Rocky River High School. There'll be another one at Harding University, another one at Audrey Kell, one at Hopewell, one at Vance, one at East Meck, one at Myers Park. And all these will be on your CMS website.
Yep.
But is there not a danger in holding these town hall meetings and you sitting there and listening a lot to what's being said and hearing what's being said, but you as the boss have to decide, of those things being said, what are the action items? What are we going to change? What are we going to move on? Somebody is going to be disappointed by this because you won't be doing one of their pet things. So if you don't implement suggestions, don't you run the risk of being perceived again as not listening?
You know this better than I. We are in an instant information age where people are very quick to tell us their opinions, and we've gone from I need an opportunity to tell you what I think, and I hope you reflect on it, to I think a society where I told you what to do and you didn't do it, therefore you didn't
exactly
listen.
Right.
I always am very clear that I am listening. I try to listen very deeply. I'm going to always consider any suggestion, idea, or thought, but I may not do what it is you're telling me to do. I have a very simple philosophical way I make decisions. Is it best for teaching, learning, and kids? I might choose plan A. You think I should do plan B. I promise you there never be any other reason than I thought plan A was going to be better for teaching, learning, and kids. But so I may have listened to you. I may have considered what it is you wanted me to think about, but just because I didn't do that doesn't mean I didn't listen. You know, what's been amazing so far, we had an employee town hall on Monday, and so I was listening to some of the comments, the suggestions, the ideas. That allows me to go back and start to say, this is what I'm hearing, and it does start to separate fact from fiction. But even so, I heard from several people that they have concerns about our assistant principal selection process. They don't think we have a process. We actually do have a process. It's actually not a bad process. The problem is nobody knows about the process. And the biggest part of the process is when people don't get an assistant principalship, we're not telling them why so that they can improve in the future. So just that simple, I can now tell people we do have a process, here's what it is, but then we can improve it immediately because we've got to tell people who went through that process and didn't get the position why so that they can improve. So it's helping me immeasurably. I know what the community kind of wants right now is they want me to step forward in front of a podium and say, here are the 10 things we're going to do immediately. I think that's really silly in terms of what the leader should do. I think you first come in trying to assess where we are. You really get a sense of where we need to be. Then you have to decide how far are we away from that preferred state. And then you build a plan and a strategy that has buy-in. I think if there was anything that really yielded some very good results in a short period of time in Reno was that I didn't come in with a game plan. I came in with an entry plan. We listened. We created a plan that many, many people in the community felt they had an involvement in.
You came in here with an entry plan because I've read it yesterday.
Exactly. Yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah. All right. Dr. Heath Morrison is here, and part of his entry plan is to listen. And that begins tonight officially with parents and students and others, educators at Rocky River High School. But it really begins right now. And just like Grace Slick, you've attracted a studio audience. And they have some questions. At least somebody has stepped up to our microphone here. So welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for your remarks. Talk to us a little bit about discipline in the public schools. We have a lot of teachers among us, and that seems to be one of the issues that teachers are always talking about, discipline in public schools, and how do you address that, and how can our teachers feel comforted that you're going to lead in a way that allows the teachers to feel like they can have discipline in the classroom that's effective?
Yeah, fantastic. Appreciate the question. So my philosophy about discipline as an educational leader is that we have to remember discipline serves two primary purposes. First of all, there is a punitive aspect to it. You did something you shouldn't have. We have to have a consequence for that, and we need to make sure that those consequences are well known and that we are consistent across 159 schools and consistent across over 8,000 teachers and across 159 principals. So getting that consistency, having a framework where a infraction at one school doesn't yield hardly any punitive action, but another school yields a great punitive action. But I think the part that we do miss is that discipline also should be educational as well. We're trying to teach a young person not to do something negative again. And so I think we tend to be focused totally on the consequence without realizing that it really is about trying to change behavior. So we need to have a discipline framework for the district. It needs to be contextual for each school. We need to equip our schools with enough strategies. Here's what I know. It used to be back when you were in education, it was true for me too, a suspension from school really meant something. And actually, it wasn't the suspension from school. It was mom and dad. When mom and dad found out that you were getting suspended, that had some pretty bad consequences at home.
Yes, and mom and dad sided with the teacher then.
Yes, always, okay? Today, you know, for a lot of our young people, when they get suspended, it's a good day because mom and dad aren't home. They get a free day at home, free day to watch TV, free day to eat whatever they want. So it fails to be a consequence. So what we have to do is we have to have a lot of tools in the toolbox so that when a student does something they shouldn't have done at school, that they understand they made a mistake, that the consequences get them to have a change of behavior, and that we equip our principals and we equip our schools with enough different options so that it's not just a suspension. Suspension has to be a part of it, but it can't be the only part of it. Now, the other thing I just want to say about this is there's some amazing data coming out of Harvard University around a gentleman who did a study called the 7 Keys of Effective Teaching. And those 7 keys are the key essentials that really yield great results in a classroom. And out of these 7 C's, they're all things you would expect, caring, challenge, but there's also one called control. And what he found is that the most effective teachers have amazing control of their class, and children want control. They want to be in a classroom that's structured, that's disciplined. And I think we've tended to forget that as we help our teachers entry into the teaching profession because we assume that they have all those skills. First and second year teachers often struggle with classroom management and discipline. So knowing those things helps us build professional capacity to help them do a better job with our children.
Put your headphones on for a second. We'll take a call and we'll come to another studio participant here. Jessica in Charlotte, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good morning, Dr. Morrison. Welcome to Charlotte.
Good morning, Jessica.
I'd like your thoughts on communications between the district and parents. As an example, which is quite typical for me, I got an email this week requesting a payment on a tight deadline, and the email had nothing in the subject line, and I didn't recognize the person it was coming from, and I came very close to deleting it. And this is really typical. And I think this also is a, you know, a question about systems and processes with communication. So I'd like your thoughts on that.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for the question. And what's really important for me is that as a district, we have great communications, that we are actively and proactively seeking input, that we are diligent and timely and pushing information out to our parents that they need to know and understand how they can help support their children in schools. This week, we have a communication audit going on in our school district that I requested because I want to know things exactly what you're saying. Where are we as a district failing to communicate with our community, especially our parents? You know, what I know is that parents, the more they know about what's happening at the school, the more involved they are. And so I want to make sure that our communications with our parents are proactive, that they're timely, and that they're differentiated, because while some parents might want to be best communicated through email, others need that personal contact through a telephone call or a personal meeting. We need to differentiate our communications to parents as much as we pride ourselves on trying to differentiate instruction for children.
Okay. Off to our studio audience again. Welcome.
Another topic that you've raised up repeatedly is commitment to your students and to the school district. What about the students' commitment to the school, to the students' commitment? You talk about discipline and how a suspension might be a good consequence for the students, but if the students are committed to the school and see the value of it, they're going to be your messengers every day coming back to the community to tell their parents what a great school is. So what are you doing to boost student commitment and also boost the connection that the students make with what they're learning there, with what they can do with it in the outside world after they graduate?
Yeah, that's a huge question, so let me try to honor it as best I can. What I'm trying to do right now is to assess exactly where we are on that topic. I think students have to feel engaged at their school. Students have to feel a sense of pride at their schools to really come forward and do their best work. I think one of the areas that we've really been lax on across our public education systems in the country, it was something that we were just getting very proactive in my former school district, was around social-emotional learning needs. But if you know anything about social-emotional learning needs, that old Maslow's hierarchy of needs, you have to address things that children need to know to be ready to learn. And the more you address those, more that students know that you really care, then they care about what we know, and then there's a greater sense of pride and belonging to that community. We have to look at how students are feeling engaged in our schools in multiple ways. Do all students feel valued? Do our brightest students feel engaged? Do our students who come to school with great challenges, do they feel that school is a welcoming, nurturing environment? So that question really ranges from everything, how we deal with anti-bullying, to how we use technology in the schools, to how our schools are a welcoming environment, cultural proficiency. It's a huge question. I'm just really unpacking it.
Joseph on Facebook has a question about something you just said. How is CMS implementing the anti-bullying measure of 2010, particularly when it comes to LGBT or perceived LGBT kids?
Well, again, you know, having just started in July 1, I'm asking all those questions. So every time I'm sitting in the meeting, I'm pushing, I'm asking for data, I'm going home, finishing my last meeting at 11 o'clock, and then trying to spend a couple hours pouring through materials. Overall, I think there's a big commitment on our school district to try to be very aggressive against anti-bullying, and that includes all students who are bullied for any reason, including LGBT issues. So I wish I could give a more substantive answer than that, other than what I've heard so far, what I've seen so far. I think we're on the right track. But what I also know is I've seen data that shows far too many of our children come to school and they have been victims of bullying and harassment. So we have a lot of ways to go to make improvements.
Sharon writes, "We are so focused on No Child Left Behind that we are holding back kids who are at the top of the class. Why are we not excited and focused on those kids? A lot of kindergartners come in knowing the curriculum already and are bored to tears. The curriculum needs to be boosted about 2 grade levels for some kids. I was told by a teacher we are not allowed to teach ahead." What?
Yeah, so I wish I could have articulated one of my primary concerns about No Child Left Behind, but she articulated much better than I do. While I applaud much of No Child Left Behind, I believe the biggest issue with No Child Left Behind is it has left our brightest kids behind. We have created this whole generation of bubble kids. And so if you're a couple of months ahead before the test and you're in fifth grade and you're reading at a seventh grade reading level, I'm reading at a second grade reading level, and then another student's reading at the fourth grade reading level, the teacher in some ways has to stop teaching you because you're already where you need to be. they stop teaching me because they won't be able to get me where I need to be. So they put all of their eggs in this bubble child, the student who's on a fourth grade reading level because they got to get them to fifth. And so when this law called new child left behind, the consequences were leaving two out of the three kids behind. We owe, when I say in CMS, as superintendent, I'm going to make every decision about every child every day for a better tomorrow, I mean every child. And we owe as much promise, as much focus, as much intentionality towards the kids who are ahead, our brightest kids, as we do the children who come far behind. It can't just be about some children. It must be about all children.
We don't have much time left. Sarah says it seems inevitable that a merit pay program is going to happen, whether teachers like it or not. As a teacher, it's very frustrating to watch politicians tell me how to best evaluate what I do, about how about turning it over to the teachers, recruit CMS teachers to develop a merit pay system that they feel is fair.
These are great questions because they're exactly the same thoughts that I'm having. You know, I think as the leader, one of the things my job is to do is to look ahead to things. What are future impacts and how do you take challenges and make them opportunities? I think it's not hard to see nationally, statewide, there's more and more call to have pay-for-performance systems. And so if it's coming, what I'd rather do is position CMS to have the template for one that is the very best. It won't be the very best unless we engage our teachers. And so as we start to explore any possibility of a pay-for-performance system, merit pay, whatever you want to call it, it will be done with our teachers. When I was in Reno, we had to, by state law, create a pay-for-performance system. We did it with our teachers' association. And when we presented it to our board, our teachers' association was there to applaud it and support it.
Dr. Heath Morrison, the new superintendent of Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools, we could go on with this conversation till noon at least today, but there'll be a chance for you to do this tonight at 6 at Rocky River High School, and then again September 17th at Harding University High. Thank you for the hour. Come back soon.
I will, and go Titans.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The producer is Tim Ross. The associate producer is Aaron Sutton. And our engineer...